down handwritten or rather finger-written notes. It is much more soothing to write longhand instead of having to go through the agency of a keyboard. My dream would be to someday write everything longhand, as almost every writer did before modernity. So it may be a natural property of technology to only want to be displaced by itself. Next, let me show how the future is mostly in the past. To age in reverse, the Lindy effect. Time to get more technical, so a distinction is helpful at this stage. Let us separate the perishable, humans, single items, from the non-perishable, the potentially perennial. The non-perishable is anything that does not have an organic, unavoidable expiration date. The perishable is typically an object. The non-perishable has an informational nature to it. A single car is perishable, but the automobile as a technology has survived about a century, and we will speculate should survive another one. Humans die, but their genes, a code, do not necessarily. The physical book is perishable, say a specific copy of the Old Testament, but its contents are not, as they can be expressed into another physical book. Let me express my idea in Lebanese dialect first. When you see a young and an old human, you can be confident that the younger will survive the elder. With something non-perishable, say a technology, that is not the case. We have two possibilities. Either both are expected to have the same additional life expectancy, the case in which the probability distribution is called exponential, or the old is expected to have a longer expectancy than the young, in proportion to their relative age. In that situation, if the old is 80 and the young is 10, the elder is expected to live 8 times as long as the younger one. Now conditional on something belonging to either category, I propose the following, building on the so-called Lindy effect in the version later developed by the great Benoit Mandelbrot. For the perishable, every additional day in its life translates into a shorter additional life expectancy. For the non-perishable, every additional day may imply a longer life expectancy. So the longer a technology lives, the longer it can be expected to live. Let me illustrate the point. People have difficulty understanding it at the first go. Say I have for sole information about a gentleman that he is 40 years old, and I want to predict how long he will live. I can look at actuarial tables and find his age-adjusted life expectancy as used by insurance companies. The table will predict that he has an extra 44 to go. Next year, when he turns 41, or equivalently, if apply the reasoning today to another person currently 41, he will have a little more than 43 years to go. So every year that elapses reduces his life expectancy by about a year, actually a little less than a year. So if his life expectancy at birth is 80, his life expectancy at 80 will not be zero, but another decade or so. The opposite applies to non-perishable items. I am simplifying numbers here for clarity. If a book has been in print for 40 years, I can expect it to be in print for another 40 years. But, and that is the main difference, if it survives another decade, then it will be expected to be in print another 50 years. This, simply, as a rule, tells you why things that have been around for a long time are not aging like persons, but aging in reverse. Every year that passes without extinction doubles the additional life expectancy. This is an indicator of some robustness. The robustness of an item is proportional to its life. The physicist Richard Gott applied what appeared to be completely different reasoning to state that whatever we observe in a randomly selected way is likely to be neither in the beginning nor in the end of its life, most likely in its middle. His argument was criticized for being rather incomplete. But by testing his argument, he tested the one I just outlined above, that the expected life of an item is proportional to its past life. Gott made a list of Broadway shows on a given day, May 17, 1993, and predicted that the longest-running ones would last longest, and vice versa. He was proven right with 95% accuracy. He had, as a child, visited both the Great Pyramid, 5,700 years old, and the Berlin Wall, 12 years old, and correctly guessed that the former would outlive the latter. The proportionality of life expectancy does not need to be tested explicitly. It is the direct result of winner-take-all effects in longevity. Two mistakes are commonly made when I present this idea. People have difficulties grasping probabilistic notions, particularly when they have spent too much time on the Internet. Not that they need the Internet to be confused. We are naturally probability-challenged. The first mistake is usually in the form of the presentation of the counterexample of a technology that we currently see as inefficient and dying, like, say, telephone landlines, print newspapers, and cabinets containing paper receipts for tax purposes. These arguments come with anger, as many neomaniacs get offended by my point. But my argument is not about every technology, but about life expectancy, which is simply a probabilistically derived average. If I know that a 40-year-old has terminal pancreatic cancer, I will no longer estimate his life expectancy using unconditional insurance tables. It would be a mistake to think that he has 44 more years to live, like others in his age group who are cancer-free. Likewise, someone, a technology guru, interpreted my idea as suggesting that the World Wide Web, being currently less than about 20 years old, will only have another 20 to go. This is a noisy estimator that should work on average, not in every case. But in general, the older the technology, not only the longer is it expected to last, but the more certainty I can attach to such a statement. Remember the following principle. I am not saying that all technologies do not age, only that those technologies that were prone to aging are already dead. The second mistake is to believe that one would be acting young by adopting a young technology, revealing both a logical error and mental bias. It leads to the inversion of the power of generational contributions, producing the illusion of the contribution of the new generation over the old. Statistically, the young do almost nothing. This mistake has been made by many people. But most recently, I saw an angry futuristic consultant who accuses people who don't jump into technology of thinking old. He is actually older than I am and, like most technomaniacs I know, looks sickly and pear-shaped and has an undefined transition between his jaw and his neck. I didn't understand why one would be acting particularly old by loving things historical. So by loving the classics, older, I would be acting older than if I were interested in the younger medieval themes. This is a mistake similar to believing that one would turn into a cow by eating cow meat. It is actually a worse fallacy than the inference from eating. A technology, being informational rather than physical, does not age organically like humans, at least not necessarily so. The wheel is not old in the sense of experiencing degeneracy. This idea of young and old, attached to certain crowd behavior, is even more dangerous. Supposedly, if those who don't watch pre-packaged 18-minute hyped-up lectures on the web paid attention to people in their teens and 20s who do, and in whom supposedly the key to the future lies, they would be thinking differently. Much progress comes from the young because of their relative freedom from the system and courage to take action that older people lose as they become trapped in life. But it is precisely the young who propose ideas that are fragile, not because they are young, but because most unseasoned ideas are fragile. And of course, someone who sells futuristic ideas will not make a lot of money selling the value of the past. New technology is easier to hype up. I received an interesting letter from Paul Doolin from Zurich, who was wondering how we could teach children skills for the 21st century, since we do not know which skills will be needed in the 21st century. He figured out an elegant application of the large problem that Karl Popper called the error of historicism. Effectively, my answer would be to make them read the classics. The future is in the past. Actually, there's an Arabic proverb to that effect. He who does not have a past has no future. A few mental biases. Next, I present an application of the fooled by randomness effect. Information has a nasty property. It hides failures. Many people have been drawn to, say, financial markets after hearing success stories of someone getting rich in the stock market and building a large mansion across the street. But since failures are buried and we don't hear about them, investors are led to overestimate their chances of success. The same applies to the writing of novels. We do not see the wonderful novels that are now completely out of print. We just think that because the novels that have done well are well written, whatever that means, that what is well written will do well. So we confuse the necessary and the causal. Because all surviving technologies have some obvious benefits, we are led to believe that all technologies offering obvious benefits will survive. I will leave the discussion of what impenetrable property may help survival to the section on Empedocles' dog. But note here the mental bias that causes people to believe in the power of some technology and its ability to run the world. Another mental bias causing the overhyping of technology comes from the fact that we notice change, not statics. The classic example, discovered by the psychologists Daniel Kahneman and Amos Tversky, applies to wealth. The pair developed the idea that our brains like minimal effort and get trapped that way, and they pioneered a tradition of cataloging and mapping human biases with respect to perception of random outcomes and decision-making under uncertainty. If you announce to someone, "You lost $10,000, he will be much more upset than if you tell him your portfolio value, which was $785,000, is now $775,000. Our brains have a predilection for shortcuts, and the variation is easier to notice and store than the entire record. It requires less memory storage. This psychological heuristic, often operating without our awareness, the error of variation in place of total, is quite pervasive, even in matters that are visual. We notice what varies and changes more than what plays a large role but doesn't change. We rely more on water than on cell phones, but because water does not change and cell phones do, we are prone to thinking that cell phones play a larger role than they do. Second, because the new generations are more aggressive with technology, we notice that they try more things, but we ignore that these implementations don't usually stick. Most innovations are failures, just as most books are flops, which should not discourage anyone from trying. Neomania and treadmill effects. You are driving on the highway in your 2-year-old Japanese car when you are overtaken by a vehicle of the same make, the latest version, that looks markedly different and markedly better. Markedly better? The bumper is slightly larger and the taillights are wider. Other than these cosmetic details, and perhaps some hidden technical improvements, representing less than a few percentage points in variation, the car looks the same, but you can't tell by just looking at it. You just see the lights and feel that you are due an upgrade. And the upgrade will cost you, after you sell your car, about a third of the price of a new vehicle. All that motivated by small, mostly cosmetic variations. But switching cars is a small cost compared to switching computers. The recovery value of an old computer is so negligible. You use an Apple Mac computer. You just bought a new version the week before. The person on the plane next to you just pulled out of his bag an older version. It has a family resemblance to yours, but looks so inferior. It is thicker and has a much less elegant screen. But you forget the days when you used to have the same model and were thrilled with it. The same with a cell phone. You look down at those carrying older, larger models. But a few years ago, you would have considered these small and slick. So with so many technologically driven and modernistic items, skis, cars, computers, computer programs, it seems that we notice differences between versions rather than commonalities. We even rapidly tire of what we have, continuously searching for versions 2.0 and similar iterations. And after that, another improved reincarnation. These impulses to buy new things that will eventually lose their novelty, particularly when compared to newer things, are called treadmill effects. As the listener can see, they arise from the same generator of biases as the one about the salience of variations mentioned in the section before. We notice differences and become dissatisfied with some items and some classes of goods. This treadmill effect has been investigated by Danny Kahneman and his peers when they studied the psychology of what they call hedonic states. People acquire a new item, feel more satisfied after an initial boost, then rapidly revert to their baseline of well-being. So when you upgrade, you feel a boost of satisfaction with changes in technology, But then you get used to it and start hunting for the new thing. But it looks as though we don't incur the same treadmilling techno-dissatisfaction with classical art, older furniture, whatever we do not put in the category of the technological. You may have an oil painting and a flat-screen television set inhabiting the same room of your house. The oil painting is an imitation of a classic Flemish scene made close to a century ago, with the dark, ominous skies of Flanders, majestic trees, and an uninspiring but calmative rural scene. I am quite certain that you are not eager to upgrade the oil painting, but that soon your flat-screen TV set will be donated to the local chapter of some kidney foundation. The same with dishes. Recall that we try to replicate 19th-century dinner customs, so there is at least one other domain in which we do not try to optimize matters. I am initially writing these lines longhand, using a seasoned fountain pen. I do not fuss over the state of my pens. Many of them are old enough to cross decades. One of them, the best, I have had for at least 30 years. Nor do I obsess over small variations in the paper. I prefer to use Clairefontaine paper and notebooks that have hardly changed since my early childhood. If anything, they have degraded in quality. But when it comes to transcribing my writing into electronic form, then I get worried that my Mac computer may not be the best tool for the job. I heard somewhere that the new version had a longer-lasting battery, and I plan to upgrade soon, during my next impulse buying episode. Note, here is a strange inconsistency in the way we perceive items across the technological and real domains. Whenever I sit on an airplane next to some businessman reading the usual trash businessmen read on an e-reader, said business person will not resist disparaging my use of the book by comparing the two items. Supposedly, an e-reader is more efficient. It delivers the essence of the book, which said businessman assumes is information, but in a more convenient way, as he can carry a library on his device and optimize his time between golf outings. I have never heard anyone address the large differences between e-readers and physical books, like smell, texture, dimension. Books are in three dimensions. Color, ability to change pages, physicality of an object compared to a computer screen, and hidden properties causing unexplained differences in enjoyment. The focus of the discussion will be commonalities, how close to a book this wonderful device is. Yet, when he compares his version of an e-reader to another e-reader, he will invariably focus on minute differences. Just as when Lebanese run into Syrians, they focus on the tiny variations in their respective Levantine dialects, but when Lebanese run into Italians, they focus on similarities. There may be a heuristic that helps put such items in categories. First, the electronic on-off switch. Whatever has an off or on switch that I need to turn off before I get yelled at by the flight attendant will necessarily be in one category, but not the opposite, as many items without an on-off switch will be prone to neomania. For these items, I focus on variations with attendant neomania. But consider the difference between the artisanal, the other category, and the industrial. What is artisanal has the love of the maker infused in it and tends to satisfy. We don't have this nagging impression of incompleteness we encounter with electronics. It also so happens that whatever is technological happens to be fragile. Articles made by an artisan cause fewer treadmill effects, and they tend to have some anti-fragility. Recall how my artisanal shoes take months before becoming comfortable. Items with an on-off switch tend to have no such redeeming anti-fragility. But alas, some things we wish were a bit more fragile. Which brings us to architecture. Architecture and the irreversible neomania. There is some evolutionary warfare between architects producing a compounded form of neomania. The problem with modernistic and functional architecture is that it is not fragile enough to break physically, so these buildings stick out just to torture our consciousness. You cannot exercise your prophetic powers by leaning on their fragility. Urban planning, incidentally, demonstrates the central property of the so-called top-down effect. Top-down is usually irreversible, so mistakes tend to stick, whereas bottom-up is gradual and incremental, with creation and destruction along the way, though presumably with a positive slope. Further, things that grow in a natural way, whether cities or individual houses, have a fractal quality to them. Like everything alive, all organisms, like lungs or trees, grow in some form of self-guided but tame randomness. What is fractal? Recall Mandelbrot's insight in Chapter 3. Fractal entails both jaggedness and a form of self-similarity in things. Mandelbrot preferred self-affinity, such as trees spreading into branches that look like small trees, and smaller branches that look like a slightly modified but recognizable version of the whole. These fractals induce a certain wealth of detail based on small number of rules of repetition of nested patterns. The fractal requires some jaggedness, but one that has some method to its madness. Everything in nature is fractal, jagged, and rich in detail, though with a certain pattern. The smooth, by comparison, belongs to the class of Euclidean geometry we study in school, simplified shapes that lose this layer of wealth. Alas, contemporary architecture is smooth, even when it tries to look whimsical. What is top-down is generally unwrinkled, that is, unfractal, and feels dead. Sometimes modernism can take a naturalistic turn, then stop in its tracks. Gaudí's buildings in Barcelona, from around the turn of the 20th century, are inspired by nature and rich architecture, Baroque and Moorish. I managed to visit a rent-controlled apartment there. It felt like an improved cavern with rich, jagged details. I was convinced that I had been there in a previous life. Wealth of details, ironically, leads to inner peace. Yet Gaudí's idea went nowhere, except in promoting modernism in its unnatural and naive versions. Later, modernistic structures are smooth and completely stripped of fractal jaggedness. I also enjoy writing facing trees and, if possible, wild, untamed gardens with ferns. But white walls with sharp corners and Euclidean angles and crisp shapes strain me. And once they are built, there is no way to get rid of them. Almost everything built since World War II has an unnatural smoothness to it. For some, these buildings cause even more than aesthetic harm. Many Romanians are bitter about the dictator Nicolae Ceaușescu's destruction of traditional villages replaced by modern high-rises. Neomania and dictatorship are an explosive combination. In France, some blame the modernistic architecture of housing projects for the immigrant riots. As the journalist Christopher Caldwell wrote about the unnatural living conditions, Le Corbusier called houses machines for living. France's housing projects, as we now know, became machines for alienation. Jane Jacobs, the New York urban activist, took a heroic stance as a political style resistant against neomania in architecture and urban planning, as the modernistic dream was carried by Robert Moses, who wanted to improve New York by raising tenements and installing large roads and highways, committing a greater crime against natural order than Haussmann, who, as we saw in Chapter 7, removed during the 19th century entire neighborhoods of Paris to make room for the grand boulevards. Jacobs stood against tall buildings as they deform the experience of urban living, which is conducted at street level. Further, her bone with Robert Moses concerns the highway, as these engines for travel suck life out of the city. To her, a city should be devoted to pedestrians. Again, we have the machine-organism dichotomy. To her, the city is an organism. For Moses, it is a machine to be improved upon. Indeed, Moses had plans to raise the West Village. It is thanks to her petitions and unremitting resistance that the neighborhood, the prettiest in Manhattan, has survived nearly intact. One might want to give Moses some credit, for not all his projects turned out to be nefarious. Some might have been beneficial, such as the parks and beaches now accessible to the middle class thanks to the highways. Recall the discussion of municipal properties. They don't translate into something larger because problems become more abstract as they scale up, and the abstract is not something human nature can manage properly. The same principle needs to apply to urban life. Neighborhoods are villages and need to remain villages. I was recently stuck in a traffic jam in London where, one hears, the speed of traveling is equal to what it was a century and a half ago, if not slower. It took me almost 2 hours to cross London from one end to the other. As I was depleting the topics of conversation with the Polish driver, I wondered whether Haussmann was not right, and whether London would be better off if it had its Haussmann raising neighborhoods and plowing wide arteries to facilitate circulation. until it hit me that, in fact, if there was so much traffic in London as compared to other cities, it was because people wanted to be there, and being there for them exceeded the costs. More than a third of the residents in London are foreign-born, and, in addition to immigrants, most high-net-worth individuals on the planet get their starter pied-à-terre in central London. It could be that the absence of these large avenues and absence of a dominating state is part of its appeal. Nobody would buy a pied-à-terre in Brasilia, the perfectly top-down city built from scratch on a map. I also checked and saw that the most expensive neighborhoods in Paris today, such as the 6th arrondissement or Île Saint-Louis, were the ones that had been left alone by the 19th-century renovators. Finally, the best argument against teleological design is as follows. Even after they are built, buildings keep incurring mutations as if they needed to slowly evolve and be taken over by the dynamical environment. They change colors, shapes, windows, and character. In his book, How Buildings Learn, Stuart Brand shows in pictures how buildings change through time, as if they needed to metamorphose into unrecognizable shapes. Strangely, buildings, when erected, do not account for the optionality of future alterations. Wall-to-wall windows. The skepticism about architectural modernism that I am proposing is not unconditional. While most of it brings unnatural stress, some elements are a certain improvement. For instance, floor-to-ceiling windows in a rural environment expose us to nature. Here again, technology making itself literally invisible. In the past, the size of windows was dictated by thermal considerations, as insulation was not possible. Heat escaped rather quickly from windows. Today's materials allow us to avoid such constraint. Further, much French architecture was a response to the tax on windows and doors installed after the Revolution, so many buildings have a very small number of windows. Just as with the unintrusive shoes that allow us to feel the terrain, modern technology allows some of us to reverse that trend, as expressed by Oswald Spengler, which makes civilization go from plants to stone, that is, from the fractal to the Euclidean. We are now moving back from the smooth stone to the rich fractal and natural. Benoit Mandelbrot wrote in front of a window overlooking trees. He craved fractal aesthetics so much that the alternative would have been inconceivable. Now modern technology allows us to merge with nature, and instead of a small window, an entire wall can be transparent and face lush and densely forested areas. Metrification. One example of the neomania of states, the campaign for metrification, that is, the use of the metric system to replace archaic ones on grounds of efficiency. It makes sense. The logic might be impeccable, until, of course, one supersedes it with a better, less naive logic, an attempt I will make here. Let us look at the wedge between rationalism and empiricism in this effort. Warwick Cairns, a fellow similar to Jane Jacobs, has been fighting in courts to let market farmers in Britain keep selling bananas by the pound, and similar matters, as they have resisted the use of the more rational kilogram. The idea of metrification was born out of the French Revolution, as part of the utopian mood, which includes changing the names of the winter months to nivos, pluvios, ventos, descriptive of weather, having decimal time, 10-day weeks, and similar naively rational matters. Luckily, the project of changing time has failed. However, after repeated failures, the metric system was implemented there. But the old system has remained refractory in the United States and England. The French writer Edmond Abou, who visited Greece in 1832, a dozen years after its independence, reports how peasants struggled with the metric system as it was completely unnatural to them, and stuck to Ottoman standards instead. Likewise, the modernization of the Arabic alphabet from the easy-to-memorize old Semitic sequence made to sound like words, Abjad, Hawaz, to the logical sequence, Aleph, Ba, Ta, Tha, has created a generation of Arabic speakers without the ability to recite their alphabet. But few realize that naturally born weights have a logic to them. We use feet, miles, pounds, inches, furlongs, stones in Britain, because these are remarkably intuitive and we can use them with a minimal expenditure of cognitive effort. and all cultures seem to have similar measurements with some physical correspondence to the everyday. A meter does not match anything. A foot does. I can imagine the meaning of 30 feet with minimal effort. A mile, from the Latin milia passum, is 1,000 paces. Likewise, a stone, 14 pounds, corresponds to, well, a stone. An inch, or pouce, corresponds to a thumb. A furlong is the distance one can sprint before running out of breath. A pound, from libra, is what you can imagine holding in your hands. Recall from the story of Thales in chapter 12 that we used thekel or shekel. These mean weight in Canaanite Semitic languages, something with a physical connotation, similar to the pound. There is a certain non-randomness to how these units came to be in an ancestral environment, and the digital system itself comes from the correspondence to the 10 fingers. As I am writing these lines, no doubt, some European Union official of the type who eats 200 grams of well-cooked meat with 200 centiliters worth of red wine every day for dinner, the optimal quantity for his health benefits, is concocting plans to promote the efficiency of the metric system deep into the countryside of the member countries. Turning science into journalism. So, we can apply criteria of fragility and robustness to the handling of information. The fragile in that context is, like technology, what does not stand the test of time. The best filtering heuristic, therefore, consists in taking into account the age of books and scientific papers. Books that are 1 year old are usually not worth reading, a very low probability of having the qualities for surviving, no matter the hype and how earth-shattering they may seem to be. So I follow the Lindy effect as a guide in selecting what to read. Books that have been around for 10 years will be around for 10 more. Books that have been around for 2 millennia should be around for quite a bit of time, and so forth. Many understand this point, but do not apply it to academic work, which is, in much of its modern practice, hardly different from journalism, except for the occasional original production. Academic work, because of its attention-seeking orientation, can be easily subjected to Lindy effects. Think of the hundreds of thousands of papers that are just noise, in spite of how hyped they were at the time of publication. The problem in deciding whether a scientific result or a new innovation is a breakthrough, that is, the opposite of noise, is that one needs to see all aspects of the idea, and there is always some opacity that time and only time can dissipate. Like many people watching cancer research like a hawk, I fell for the following. There was at some point a great deal of excitement about the work of Judah Folkman, who, as we saw in chapter 15, believed that one could cure cancer by choking the blood supply. Tumors require nutrition and tend to create new blood vessels, what is called neovascularization. The idea looked impeccable on paper, but, about a decade and a half later, it appears that the only significant result we got was completely outside cancer, in the mitigation of macular degeneration. Likewise, seemingly uninteresting results that go unnoticed can, years later, turn out to be breakthroughs. So time can act as a cleanser of noise by confining to its dustbins all these overhyped works. Some organizations even turn such scientific production into a cheap spectator sport, with ranking of the 10 hottest papers in, say, rectal oncology or some such sub-sub-specialty. If we replace scientific results with scientists, we often get the same neomaniac hype. There is a disease to grant a prize for a promising scientist under 40, a disease that is infecting economics, mathematics, finance, etc. Mathematics is a bit special because the value of its results can be immediately seen, so I skip the criticism. Of the fields I am familiar with, such as literature, finance, and economics, I can pretty much ascertain that the prizes given to those under 40 are the best reverse indicator of value, much like the belief, well tested, by traders that companies that get hyped up for their potential and called best on the cover of magazines or in books such as Good to Great are about to underperform, and one can derive an abnormal profit by shorting their stock. The worst effect of these prizes is penalizing those who don't get them and debasing the field by turning it into an athletic competition. Should we have a prize, it should be for over 100. It took close to 140 years to validate the contribution of one Jules Regnault, who discovered optionality and mapped it mathematically, along with what we dubbed the Philosopher's Stone. His work stayed obscure all this time. Now, if you want to be convinced of my point of how noisy science can be, take any elementary textbook you read in high school or college with interest then, in any discipline. Open it to a random chapter and see if the idea is still relevant. Odds are that it may be boring, but still relevant, or non-boring and still relevant. It could be the famous 1215 Magna Carta, British history, Caesar's Gallic Wars, Roman history, a historical presentation of the School of Stoics, philosophy, an introduction to quantum mechanics, physics, or the genetic trees of cats and dogs, biology. Now try to get the proceedings of a random conference about the subject matter concerned that took place 5 years ago. Odds are it will feel no different from a 5-year-old newspaper, perhaps even less interesting. So attending breakthrough conferences might be, statistically speaking, as much a waste of time as buying a mediocre lottery ticket, one with a small payoff. The odds of the papers being relevant and interesting in 5 years is no better than 1 in 10,000. The fragility of science. Even the conversation of a high school teacher or that of an unsuccessful college professor is likely to be more worthwhile than the latest academic paper, less corrupted with neomania. My best conversations in philosophy have been with French lycée teachers who love the topic but are not interested in pursuing a career writing papers in it. In France, they teach philosophy in the last year of high school. Amateurs in any discipline are the best, if you can connect with them. Unlike dilettantes, career professionals are to knowledge what prostitutes are to love. Of course, you may be lucky enough to hit on a jewel here and there. But in general, at best, conversation with an academic would be like the conversation of plumbers, at the worst that of a concierge bandying the worst brand of gossip. Gossip about uninteresting people, other academics, small talk. True, the conversation of top scientists can sometimes be captivating. Those people who aggregate knowledge and for whom cruising the subject is effortless as the entire small parts of the field come glued together. But these people are just currently too rare on this planet. I complete this section with the following anecdote. One of my students, who was majoring in, of all subjects, economics, asked me for a rule on what to read. As little as feasible from the last 20 years, except history books that are not about the last 50 years, I blurted out, with irritation as I hate such questions as, what's the best book you've ever read, or what are the 10 best books? My 10 best books ever change at the end of every summer. Also, I have been hyping Daniel Kahneman's recent book because it is largely an exposition of his research of 35 and 40 years ago, with filtering and modernization. My recommendation seemed impractical, but, after a while, the student developed a culture in original texts such as Adam Smith, Karl Marx, and Hayek, texts he believes he will cite at the age of 80. He told me that after his detoxification, he realized that all his peers do is read timely material that becomes instantly obsolete. What should break? In 2010, The Economist magazine asked me to partake in an exercise imagining the world in 2036. As they were aware of my reticence concerning forecasters, their intention was to bring a critical balance and use me as a counter to the numerous imaginative forecasts, hoping for my usual angry, dismissive, and irascible philippic. Quite surprised they were when, after a 2-hour slow walk, I wrote a series of forecasts at one go and sent them the text. They probably thought at first that I was pulling a prank on them, or that someone got the wrong email and was impersonating me. Outlining the reasoning on fragility and asymmetry, concavity to errors, I explained that I would expect the future to be populated with wall-to-wall bookshelves, the device called the telephone, artisans, and such, using the notion that most technologies that are now 25 years old should be around in another 25 years. Once again, most, not all. I have had the privilege of reading a 500-year-old book, an experience hardly different from that of reading a modern book. Compare such robustness to the lifespan of electronic documents, Some of the computer files of my manuscripts that are less than a decade old are now irretrievable. But the fragile should disappear or be weakened. Now, what is fragile? The large, optimized, over-reliant on technology, over-reliant on the so-called scientific method instead of age-tested heuristics. Corporations that are large today should be gone, as they have always been weakened by what they think is their strength, size, which is the enemy of corporations as it causes disproportionate fragility to black swans. City-states and small corporations are more likely to be around, even thrive. The nation-state, the currency-printing central bank, these things called economics departments, may stay nominally, but they will have their power severely eroded. In other words, what we saw on the left column of the triad should be gone, alas, to be replaced by other fragile items. Profits and the present. By issuing warnings based on vulnerability, that is, subtractive prophecy, we are closer to the original role of the prophet, to warn, not necessarily to predict, and to predict calamities if people don't listen. The classical role of the prophet, at least in a Levantine sense, is not to look into the future, but to talk about the present. He tells people what to do, or rather, in my opinion, the more robust what not to do. In the Near Eastern monotheistic traditions, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, the major role of the prophets is the protection of monotheism from its idolatrous and pagan enemies that may bring calamities on the straying population. The prophet is someone who is in communication with a unique God, or at least can read his mind, and, what is key, issues warnings to his subjects. The Semitic Nabi, expressed as Nevi or Nebi in the original Hebrew, the same with minor differences in pronunciation in Aramaic, Nabi, and Arabic, Nebi, is principally someone connecting with God, expressing what is on God's mind. The meaning of Neb in Arabic is news. The original Semitic root in Akkadian, Nabu, meant to call. The initial Greek translation, prophetes, meant spokesman, which is retained in Islam as a dual role for Muhammad the prophet is that of the messenger, Rasul. There were some small ranking differences between the roles of spokesman, Nabi, and messenger, Rasul. The job of mere forecasting is rather limited to seers, or the variety of people involved in divination, such as the astrologers, so dismissed by the Quran and the Old Testament. Again, the Canaanites had been too promiscuous in their theologies and various approaches to handling the future, and the prophet is precisely someone who deals only with the one God, not with the future like a mere Baalite. Nor has the vocation of Levantine prophet been a particularly desirable professional occupation. As I said at the beginning of the chapter, acceptance was far from guaranteed. Jesus, mentioning the fate of Elijah, who warned against Baal, then ironically had to go find solace in Sidon, where Baal was worshipped, announced that no one becomes a prophet in his own land. And the prophetic mission was not necessarily voluntary. Consider Jeremiah's life, laden with Jeremiads, lamentations, as his unpleasant warnings about destruction and captivity and their causes did not make him particularly popular, and he was the personification of the notion of shoot the messenger and the expression veritas odium parit, truth brings hatred. Jeremiah was beaten, punished, persecuted, and the victim of numerous plots, which involved his own brothers. Apocryphal and imaginative accounts even have him stoned to death in Egypt. Further north of the Semites, in the Greek tradition, we find the same focus on messages, warnings about the present, and the same punishment inflicted on those able to understand things others don't. For example, Cassandra gets the gift of prophecy, along with the curse of not being believed, when the temple snakes cleaned her ears so she could hear some special messages. Tiresias was made blind and transformed into a woman for revealing the secrets of the gods, but, as a consolation, Athena licked his ears so he could understand secrets in the songs of birds. Recall the inability we saw in Chapter 2 to learn from past behavior. The problem with lack of recursion in learning, lack of second-order thinking, is as follows. if those delivering some messages deemed valuable for the long term have been persecuted in past history, one would expect that there would be a correcting mechanism, that intelligent people would end up learning from such historical experience so those delivering new messages would be greeted with the new understanding in mind. But nothing of the sort takes place. This lack of recursive thinking applies not just to prophecy, but to other human activities as well. If you believe that what will work and do well is going to be a new idea that others did not think of, what we commonly call innovation, then you would expect people to pick up on it and have a clearer eye for new ideas without too much reference to the perception of others. But they don't. Something deemed original tends to be modeled on something that was new at the time but is no longer new. So being an Einstein for many scientists means solving a similar problem to the one Einstein solved, when at the time Einstein was not solving a standard problem at all. The very idea of being an Einstein in physics is no longer original. I've detected in the area of risk management the similar error, made by scientists trying to be new in a standard way. People in risk management only consider risky things that have hurt them in the past, given their focus on evidence, not realizing that, in the past, before these events took place, these occurrences that hurt them severely were completely without precedent, escaping standards. And my personal efforts to make them step outside their shoes to consider these second-order considerations have failed, as have my efforts to make them aware of the notion of fragility. Empedocles' dog. In Aristotle's Magna Moralia, there is a possibly apocryphal story about Empedocles, the pre-Socratic philosopher, who was asked why a dog prefers to always sleep on the same tile. His answer was that there had to be some likeness between the dog and that tile. Actually, the story might be even twice as apocryphal, since we don't know if Magna Moralia was actually written by Aristotle himself. Consider the match between the dog and the tile. A natural, biological, explainable or non-explainable match, confirmed by a long series of recurrent frequentation, in place of rationalism. Just consider the history of it. Which brings me to the conclusion of our exercise in prophecy. I surmise that those human technologies such as writing and reading that have survived are like the tile to the dog, a match between natural friends, because they correspond to something deep in our nature. Every time I hear someone trying to make a comparison between a book and an e-reader, or something ancient and a new technology, opinions pop up, as if reality cared about opinions and narratives. There are secrets to our world that only practice can reveal, and no opinion or analysis will ever capture in full. This secret property is, of course, revealed through time, and thankfully, only through time. What does not make sense? Let's take this idea of Empedocles' dog a bit further. If something that makes no sense to you, say religion if you are an atheist, or some age-old habit or practice called irrational, if that something has been around for a very, very long time, then, irrational or not, you can expect it to stick around much longer and outlive those who call for its demise. Chapter 21. Medicine and Asymmetry. Decision Rules in Medical Problems. Why the Very Ill Have a Convex Payoff and the Healthy Have Concave Exposures. Medicine, Convexity, and Opacity. What they call non-evidence. Where medicine fragilizes humans, then tries to save them. Newton's Law or Evidence. The history of medicine is the story, largely documented, of the dialectic between doing and thinking, and how to make decisions under opacity. In the medieval Mediterranean, Maimonides, Avicenna, al-Ruhawi, and the Syriac doctors such as Hunayn ibn Ishaq were at once philosophers and doctors. A doctor in the medieval Semitic world was called al-Hakim, the wise, or practitioner of wisdom, a synonym for philosopher or rabbi. Hakum is the Semitic root for wisdom. Even in the earlier period, there was a crop of Hellenized fellows who stood in the exact middle between medicine and the practice of philosophy. The great skeptic philosopher Sextus Empiricus was himself a doctor member of the skeptical empirical school. So were Monodotus of Nicomedia and the experience-based predecessor of evidence-based medicine, on whom a bit more in a few pages. The works of these thinkers, or whatever remains extant, are quite refreshing for those of us who distrust those who talk without doing. Simple, quite simple decision rules and heuristics emerge from this chapter. Via negativa, of course, by removal of the unnatural. Only resort to medical techniques when the health payoff is very large, say, saving a life, and visibly exceeds its potential harm, such as the incontrovertibly needed surgery or life-saving medicine, penicillin. It is the same as with government intervention. This is squarely Thalesian, not Aristotelian. That is, decision-making based on payoffs, not knowledge. For in these cases, medicine has positive asymmetries, convexity effects, and the outcome will be less likely to produce fragility. Otherwise, in situations in which the benefits of a particular medicine, procedure, or nutritional or lifestyle modification appear small, say those aiming for comfort, we have a large potential sucker problem, hence putting us on the wrong side of convexity effects. Actually, one of the unintended side benefits of the theorems that Raphael Douadi and I developed in our paper Mapping Risk Detection Techniques in Chapter 19 is an exact link between A, nonlinearity in exposure or dose response, and B, potential fragility or antifragility. I also extend the problem to epistemological grounds and make rules for what should be considered evidence. As with whether a cup should be considered half empty or half full, there are situations in which we focus on absence of evidence, others in which we focus on evidence. In some cases, one can be confirmatory, not others. It depends on the risks. Take smoking, which was, at some stage, viewed as bringing small gains in pleasure and even health. Truly, people thought it was a good thing. It took decades for its harm to become visible. Yet, had someone questioned it, he would have faced the canned, naive, academized, and faux expert response, "Do you have evidence that this is harmful?" The same type of response as, "Is there evidence that polluting is harmful?" As usual, the solution is simple, an extension of via negativa and Fat Tony's don't be a sucker rule. The non-natural needs to prove its benefits, not the natural. According to the statistical principle outlined earlier that nature is to be considered much less of a sucker than humans. In a complex domain, only time, a long time, is evidence. For any decision, the unknown will preponderate on one side more than the other. The "do you have evidence" fallacy, mistaking evidence of no harm for no evidence of harm, is similar to the one of misinterpreting NED, no evidence of disease, for evidence of no disease. This is the same error as mistaking absence of evidence for evidence of absence, the one that tends to affect smart and educated people, as if education made people more confirmatory in their responses and more liable to fall into simple logical errors. And recall that under nonlinearities, the simple statements harmful or beneficial break down. It is all in the dosage. How to argue in an emergency room. I once broke my nose, walking, for the sake of antifragility, of course. I was trying to walk on uneven surfaces as part of my antifragility program under the influence of Loïc Lecour, who believes in naturalistic exercise. It was exhilarating. I felt the world was richer, more fractal, and when I contrasted this terrain with the smooth surfaces of sidewalks and corporate offices, those felt like prisons. Unfortunately, I was carrying something much less ancestral, a cellular phone, which had the insolence to ring in the middle of my walk. In the emergency room, the doctor and staff insisted that I should ice my nose, meaning apply an ice-cold patch to it. In the middle of the pain, it hit me that the swelling that Mother Nature gave me was most certainly not directly caused by the trauma. It was my own body's response to the injury. It seemed to me that it was an insult to Mother Nature to override her programmed reactions unless we had a good reason to do so, backed by proper empirical testing to show that we humans can do better. The burden of evidence falls on us humans. So I mumbled to the emergency room doctor whether he had any statistical evidence of benefits from applying ice to my nose, or if it resulted from a naive version of an interventionism. His response was, "You have a nose the size of Cleveland and you are now interested in numbers?" I recalled developing from his blurry remarks the thought that he had no answer. Effectively, he had no answer, because as soon as I got to a computer, I was able to confirm that there is no compelling empirical evidence in favor of the reduction of swelling, at least not outside of the very rare cases in which the swelling would threaten the patient, which was clearly not the case. It was pure sucker rationalism in the mind of doctors, following what made sense to boundedly intelligent humans, coupled with interventionism, this need to do something. This defect of thinking that we knew better, and denigration of the unobserved. This defect is not limited to our control of swelling. This confabulation plagues the entire history of medicine, along with, of course, many other fields of practice. The researchers Paul Meehl and Robin Dawes pioneered a tradition to catalog the tension between clinical and actuarial, that is, statistical, knowledge, and examine how many things believed to be true by professionals and clinicians aren't so and don't match empirical evidence. The problem is, of course, that these researchers did not have a clear idea of where the burden of empirical evidence lies, the difference between naive or pseudo-empiricism and rigorous empiricism. The onus is on the doctors to show us why reducing fever is good, why eating breakfast before engaging in activity is healthy. There is no evidence. Or why bleeding patients is the best alternative. They've stopped doing so. Sometimes I get the answer that they have no clue when they have to utter defensively, "I am a doctor," or "Are you a doctor?" But worst, I sometimes get some letters of support and sympathy from the alternative medicine fellows, which makes me go postal. The approach in this book is ultra-orthodox, ultra-rigorous, and ultra-scientific, certainly not in favor of alternative medicine. The hidden costs of healthcare are largely in the denial of anti-fragility. But it may not be just medicine. What we call diseases of civilization result from the attempt by humans to make life comfortable for ourselves against our own interest, since the comfortable is what fragilizes. The rest of this chapter focuses on specific medical cases with hidden negative convexity effects, small gains, large losses, and reframes the ideas of iatrogenics in connection with my notion of fragility and non-linearities. First principle of iatrogenics, empiricism. The first principle of iatrogenics is as follows. We do not need evidence of harm to claim that a drug or an unnatural via positiva procedure is dangerous. Recall my comment earlier with the turkey problem that harm is in the future, not in the narrowly defined past. In other words, empiricism is not naive empiricism. We saw the smoking argument. Now consider the adventure of a human-invented fat, trans fat. Somehow, humans discovered how to make fat products and, as it was the great era of scientism, they were convinced they could make it better than nature. Not just equal, better. Chemists assumed that they could produce a fat replacement that was superior to lard or butter from so many standpoints. First, it was more convenient. Synthetic products such as margarine stay soft in the refrigerator, so you can immediately spread them on a piece of bread without the usual wait while listening to the radio. Second, it was economical, as the synthetic fats were derived from vegetables. Finally, what is worst, trans fat was assumed to be healthier. Its use propagated very widely, and after a few hundred million years of consumption of animal fat, people suddenly started getting scared of it, particularly something called saturated fat, mainly from shoddy statistical interpretations. Today, trans fat is widely banned, as it turns out that it kills people, as it is behind heart disease and cardiovascular problems. For another murderous example of such sucker and fragilizing rationalism, consider the story of thalidomide. It was a drug meant to reduce the nausea episodes of pregnant women. It led to birth defects. Another drug, diethylstilbestrol, silently harmed the fetus and led to delayed gynecological cancer among daughters. These two mistakes are quite telling because, in both cases, the benefits appeared to be obvious and immediate, though small, and the harm remained delayed for years, at least three-quarters of a generation. The next discussion will be about the burden of evidence, as you can easily imagine that someone defending these treatments would have immediately raised the objection, "Monsieur Taleb, do you have evidence for your statement?" Now we can see the pattern. Iatrogenics, being a cost-benefit situation, usually results from the treacherous condition in which the benefits are small and visible, and the costs very large, delayed, and hidden. And of course, the potential costs are much worse than the cumulative gains. Second principle of iatrogenics, nonlinearity in response. Second principle of iatrogenics, it is not linear. We should not take risks with near healthy people, but we should take a lot more risks with those deemed in danger. Why do we need to focus treatment on more serious cases, not marginal ones? Take this example showing nonlinearity, convexity. When hypertension is mild, say marginally higher than the zone accepted as normotensive, the chance of benefiting from a certain drug is close to 5.6%. Only one person in 18 benefit from the treatment. But when blood pressure is considered to be in the high or severe range, the chances of benefiting are now 26 and 72% respectively. That is, one person in four and two persons out of three will benefit from the treatment. So the treatment benefits are convex to condition. The benefits rise disproportionately in an accelerated manner. But consider that the iatrogenics should be constant for all categories. In the very ill condition, the benefits are large relative to iatrogenics. In the borderline one, they are small. This means that we need to focus on high symptom conditions and ignore, I mean really ignore, other situations in which the patient is not very ill. The argument here is based on the structure of conditional survival probabilities, similar to the one that we use to prove that harm needs to be nonlinear for porcelain cups. Consider that Mother Nature had to have tinkered through selection in inverse proportion to the rarity of the condition. Of the 120,000 drugs available today, I can hardly find a via positiva one that makes a healthy person unconditionally better, and if someone shows me one, I will be skeptical of yet unseen side effects. Once in a while we come up with drugs that enhance performance, such as, say, steroids, only to discover what people in finance have known for a while. In a mature market, there is no free lunch anymore, and what appears as a free lunch has a hidden risk. When you think you have found a free lunch, say steroids or trans fat, something that helps the healthy without visible downside, it is most likely that there is a concealed trap somewhere. Actually, my days in trading, it was called a sucker's trade. And there is a simple, statistical reason that explains why we have not been able to find drugs that make us feel unconditionally better when we are well, or unconditionally stronger, etc. Nature would have been likely to find this magic pill by itself. But consider that illness is rare, and the more ill the person, the less likely nature would have found the solution by itself, in an accelerating way. A condition that is, say, 3 units of deviation away from the norm is more than 300 times rarer than normal. An illness that is 5 units of deviation from the norm is more than 1 million times rarer. The medical community has not modeled such nonlinearity of benefits to iatrogenics, and if they do so in words, I have not seen it formalized in papers, hence into a decision-making methodology that takes probability into account. As we will see in the next section, there is little explicit use of convexity biases. Even risks seem to be linearly extrapolated, causing both underestimation and overestimation, most certainly miscalculation of degrees of harm. For instance, a paper on the effect of radiation states the following. The standard model currently in use applies a linear scale, extrapolating cancer risk from high doses to low doses of ionizing radiation. Further, pharmaceutical companies are under financial pressures to find diseases and satisfy the security analysts. They have been scraping the bottom of the barrel, looking for disease among healthier and healthier people, lobbying for reclassification of conditions, and fine-tuning sales tricks to get doctors to overprescribe. Now, If your blood pressure is in the upper part of the range that used to be called normal, you are no longer normal tensive, but pre-hypertensive, even if there are no symptoms in view. There is nothing wrong with the classification if it leads to healthier lifestyle and robust via negativa measures, but what is behind such classification, often, is a drive for more medication. I am not against the function and mission of pharma, rather its business practice. They should focus for their own benefit on extreme diseases, not on reclassifications or pressuring doctors to prescribe medicines. Indeed, pharma plays on the interventionism of doctors. Another way to view it, the iatrogenics is in the patient, not in the treatment. If the